Okay, good morning. We can probably start a few minutes late, but not much. Okay, so first of all, we can take a look of your responses yesterday. Very useful for me because I understood something. So let me see, just to show you the responses. Okay. Can you see that? No, not much. Okay. I don't think that the screen can be enlarged a little bit. This is very unfortunate screen. I'm sorry. It's impossible to see. What do you see? Nothing. Okay. Okay, just forgot, maybe. No, wait. Maybe I can enlarge from here. Right. Let me see. No. Cannot from here, probably. Maybe. It's getting better? Huh? A little bit? Sorry. Okay. So there you go. Can you see that now? Yeah? Okay. A little more. Okay. So, I realized, first of all, that you have a good idea, an average of Illumina sequencing. So this is mostly due to people that had the basic level here in Torino. 50% of you say, I know very well the Illumina sequencing technology. This was made here in Torino?
Yes.
Okay. So probably the others are coming from outside. Okay. We will arrange this by... I have a proposal for you afterwards. Okay. So then there was a genome browser. On the contrary, was really... very few of you have used a genome browser before. So we spend a little time today to introduce you, okay? Very good. Then let me see. The lactase operon was a question that I give you just to know the really basic molecular biology. This is a classical story. Nobody can study molecular biology without knowing the lactase operon. That is a milestone. Okay, most of you actually know the functioning of lactase operon, but some of you not really very much, and so we will see how to arrange. It's a paradigm of regulation. Actually, we don't have in eukaryotes, I mean in human, we don't have any kind of regulation like the lactase operon, but it's a fundamental paradigm of how regulation of gene can work. So we will see. Okay. Then there was the heterochromatin distribution is quite good, I mean, but we have an entire lesson in the next week, so it's okay. Exoskipping is very lacking, but we will see. Okay, we will see. Okay, no problem. And also this guy here, nucleosome positioning was... okay, most of you don't know how to do it. No problem, we will work on it. It's okay. And then, is this working? Yeah. Okay, and then finally it was the alternative exon here, and also in this case, okay, mostly good, but there are few things that we will make a point about. Anyway, it's good. This is your, let's say, background preparation for me was very useful. So, thank you. So now we go a little bit on the course, okay? Can you see it? Not much. Okay. Just to tell you something about the next story,
Okay, first of all, we won't have the class tomorrow morning. Sorry, but I have another story at my department. I cannot avoid it. So we will recover probably next week. Okay, sometimes we'll discuss about. So tomorrow morning, on the contrary, you will start by informatics at 11. Okay. And I just take the confirmation by Professor Cordero that you will start regularly. Okay. So what I did was to open this section here. Okay. So you have, as I told you before, you have the PDF, of course, of the lesson. You have textbooks here. There are three textbooks for this part, this chapter, okay? And I'm sorry for the screen, it's really very, very bad, but I don't know how to arrange it, sorry. So this, the only one that you have to read before our next appointment, that it will be on Monday, is that correct? Okay. Is the third one here. The author is Geyer, G-E-Y-E-R. And this is the only one that you have to read now. Okay? It concerns nuclear organization. And then you can move to the research paper. Okay? And here you find the first research paper that you have to study, and we will discuss it next week. It's the only one that we discuss very deeply in the class, okay? Because I need to show you how you have to go through the paper, what you have to understand, what you have to read to try to make the point. So here there are two files. One is the paper itself, the other one is the supplementary material. Most of the papers now today have supplementary materials. You have not to read the supplementary material, but sometimes in the article they quote or they cite, they say, okay, data are shown in supplementary material, so you may be interested to go to the supplementary material to see that, okay? So this is the story, and finally, what about the activity? The activity was there were 50 attempts. That is more than you, your number, but just because some of you made more than one attempt, okay? And most of you had a good outcome. Okay, so most of you had good outcome. There are a few cases in which there was a question wrong. This is not worrying. There are a few cases in which all the questions were wrong, but I don't know. I didn't have the time to examine everything. So I don't know if you tried again. Maybe you tried again. Okay, no worry. Okay, and also this girl here. And another one. Anyway, it's okay, no problem. Probably you close the attempt without finishing, no problem. So mostly good, okay? So the distribution, mostly good, okay? It means that either you knew already the subjects that were exposed in the review, or that you have read it very thoroughly, and I am very happy about it, okay? So now, we can go to the course. This my drive. Okay, you can leave it open there, no problem. Okay, so now we try to start the lesson today. And so we start this chapter that is probably the most the largest one on the course, which concerns genomes, epigenome, and the nuclear organization. So we start to see a few things about the genomes, because as I told you yesterday, Tomorrow you will start bioinformatics, and in bioinformatics you will, as a very initial subject, you will explore how the NGS sequences is made, but also which kind of sequences you get and how the sequences are mapped to the genomes. Okay, so this is the first argument of bioinformatics. So probably we have to spend one lesson now to, probably for you, for some of you is a revision, for some of you maybe that we have some new concepts, but anyway, let's go through it. Okay. So the very first lesson of this chapter is genomes, and the human genome in particular. Okay, so we talk about DNA sequence, Human Genome Project, that was a historical side, and then next generation sequencing, databases, composition, and human variation. And I will make a tour through the genome browser that you actually don't know. Okay? So there is I won't spend time to describe to you how historically the genome project was done. But in the very last part of the Moodle site, there is a link to the Genome Project website where you find, if you want, you find tutorials very easy to see. I mean, they are very, you know, divulgative. I mean, it's popular. So they are made for non-scientific people, so very easy to see. And they explain how they managed in the past to get this important achievement that is the Human Genome Sequencing Project. So you can find it at this link. Okay. Just let me see whether the links work today. They don't. Great. They don't. Maybe yes. They don't work. Oh my god. No. Okay, sorry. Anyway, they won't in the future. So coming back to this. So these just few words on the historical, just because it's a kind of background culture you cannot avoid. The HGP, Human Genome Project, was a 23 laboratories project, so a very big project around the world. 23 labs around the world. Japanese, American, no Italian, French, Spanish, UK, Germany, and blah, blah. Okay, you can find the map if you want. And they started in 1991, so it makes a lot of time ago. And they started with a long period of physical mapping. Physical mapping means to get an idea of where genes are on the chromosomes. And this is like if you want to map all the service stations around the world, first you have to understand if this is Asia, this is Europe, this is not looking directly to the guest stations, of course. So anyway, so this is the physical mapping period, very long, as you can see. And then in 1998, they started to sequence. Okay, so each laboratory. It was not, casual that you had 23 laboratories, because we have 23 chromosomes. So each laboratory had a chromosome to sequence, okay? And they started to make a sequence. And the sequence was very demanding. Very, very, very. For one reason. Because they had only the Sanger technology at that time. And I don't know if you realize, probably all of you know more or less how the Sanger sequencing works. But probably what you don't realize completely is that Sanger sequencing can sequence only one fragment, one molecule at a time. So one reaction, one fragment. And the fragment is, at the very beginning, was something like 400 to 500 base pairs. Then in the final, let's say, in the final setting with the evolution of the machines, they arrived to 700 base pairs. Do you know how large is the human genome? Do you know it? More or less. You don't? Okay. Freddo. You, really, you don't know? It's 3.2 billion bases. Billions means 10 to the 9. Miliardi. Okay? So try to make a simple division. Take 3.2 billion and then divide by 500 bases. And tell me how many fragments you have to sequence. Okay, you understand the difficulty at that time. And also the old additional problem is that it's not like having a text in a book, okay? Because if you have a book, you have the pages, right? And the pages have a number. So if you sequence a page at a time, but you know that this is page one, this is page two, and this is page three, and so on. So no problem. But if you don't know where the fragments are in your chromosome, how you can manage? So they had only one way to go, that was this kind of hierarchical cloning. That means that they had to clone fragments of the chromosomes, okay? Fragments, in a random way, and using a hierarchical size. That means that they fragmented the first run, they made fragments of 100 to 200 kilo base pairs. That means 100,000 base pairs, very large fragments, okay? And they cloned individually each fragment in something that was called a very special vectors for cloning, very different from the plasmids that you know. Okay, this has bacterial artificial chromosome or phage artificial chromosomes. Okay, big, big stories. Okay, so they cloned that. And then they take individual clones from here, so individual big fragments of the chromosome, and subcloned, so subfragmented each of them in smaller fragments, 20 to 40 kilobases, so 20 to 40,000 base pairs, in vectors that were called cosmids or phage-derived vectors, okay? And then imagine you have big fragments, then sub-fragments in each clones like this, and then you take all individually all these fragments here, all these clones there, and sub-fragment in plasmids. So in fragments of 2 to 3 kilobases. So a very long story, extremely long story. Just to show you again how they did is this. So imagine that you have one chromosome. This is, you see there, this is a one chromosome, okay, the blue bar. And then you have, what are these small colored squares that you see? They have the physical mapping that they did before. So they knew already that a gene was here, and another gene was here. It's like having labels in the sequence, okay? So you can orient yourself, more or less, okay? Then they fragmented, okay? So they made fragments and cloned these big fragments in these back vectors, okay? So, I was telling you that it's not like a book with page number. So this requires to have clones overlapping. You see there? So, If I had only one clone and then the next, I never will understand the order. But if I have overlapping clones, I can take the sequence here and the sequence here, and if they correspond, I can say that this is before the other one. So they try to make this kind of redundant number of clones to have this overlapping situation. So if we make this calculation that I tell you, 3.2 billions divided by 500 as the number of plasmids, and then you have to multiply at least by 12 or 20 for the needed redundancy. Okay, so it's an enormous work. Okay, at that time. Okay, so if you want to have some more explanation on the strategy that the people took, you can go to the tutorials just to understand what is. But I think that the concept is there. The difficulty, I think that I illustrated very well the difficulty of that time to get complete sequence. Okay. So this this project was ended in more or less in 2003. So in 2K3, there was two publications, very famous papers, one on Science Journal and the other on Nature, showing the sequence. Why two papers and not one paper? Because actually the sequences was done in parallel by two consortia. One was the Human Genome Project, the other one was a private consortium. Okay, so they reached more or less the same results, and they published it together at that time. Okay, so the in 2003 they published the sequence, and they published, of course, some consideration about what they knew about the sequence, because having a sequence doesn't mean to understand what is written. Like having the Rosetta Stone, you see the sequence, but you don't know what is the meaning of the characters. And actually, at that time, the new known genes were very few. Okay, so they. People knew something like 3,000 to 4,000 genes, maximum. So there was a knowledge, very partial knowledge. So what they did was that they tried to make annotation of all the sequences, okay, based on different criteria. The first criteria was homology. As you probably know, many genes are similar to each other. If you dig in your mind, can you give me an example of two genes that are very similar? Think about it.
Globins.
Alpha and beta globins and gamma globins, epsilon. This is we call it the family of genes. And that, actually, I don't want to talk about evolution, but evolutionary is just because the gene duplicated, okay, sometimes in the evolution. And then each of them mutated a little bit and so on, so they gave two different genes. But there are so many, so many. Another one that you may know from the first part of the course are tyrosine kinase, like herb B. Yesterday we mentioned herb B2. In the human genome, we have at least four of those. One is AGF receptor, the other one is RB2, RB3, and B4. And they are very similar to each other. Okay? So when you try to map the genome, you can use similarity. If you find a sequence that you have no idea about it, but is similar to a known gene, you can classify it. Okay? Of course, correspondence to known RNA proteins, because you have to understand that during those years, individual laboratories were also sequencing small pieces of genes or identifying proteins and so on. So there was a convergence of data to try to characterize. Or sequence comparison with other genetic elements that are not genes, because there are many elements that are not genes. And of course, on what is called the comparative analysis, because of course the Human Genome Project was the most important, not only because we are humans, but also for the money that we spent to get it. But in parallel, there were other sequencing projects going on, like mouse, for example. Yeast, that is quite simple, it is smaller. Of course, bacteria, plants, and whatever. Okay, so making comparison between the genomes, you can reach additional information, because usually genomes are quite quite similar in when the organisms are close to each other. Anyway, this work resulted in one first classification. So this is the 2003 situation. And this, you can find this figure in many books, okay? And it was quite impressive. I mean, in that time, people, scientists, did not expect this figure. So, first of all, we had only about 1 billion that is dedicated to genes, okay? So, if you look at gene and gene-related, that means gene-related at that time was something that was similar to gene, even if not completely. Okay? And of course, a gene, as you probably all of you well know, are composed of a gene. When you look at human gene, promoter, 5' UTR, exons, introns, 3' UTR, okay? So many sequences, okay? And the coding part is a small part of all the gene, okay? So if you sum up all the coding sequences, you make only 48 million bases. That if you look through, means a very small percentage of all the genome, okay? Then you have something like related, that means similar to, but not coding. Pseudogenes, introns, UTRs, and gene fragments. As you can imagine, pseudogenes and gene fragments are nothing to do with real genes, but at that time they classified in between, okay? Look at the sizes, please. So, 1 billion and 2 related in some way to genes of these only 48 megabases coding. Okay? Then the other part is intragenic, what they call it intragenic DNA. Okay, intragenic is just because they knew only the genes, so everything that was not the gene was classified in the other side. Okay, today we know that there are many other things in the intragenic DNA. Anyway, this intragenic DNA accomplishes up to 2 billion of bases, and it's a lot. And it is subdivided, as you can see, in interspersed repeat. What is an interspersed repeat? Is a sequence that has many copies, but not tandem, not one following the other one, but interspersed in different chromosomes or different genomes, okay? Different parts of the chromosome. Okay? And this interspersed repeat is the largest part, 1.4 giga, so 1.4 billion, okay? And they are composed of lines, LTR elements, signs, and transposons. We will see something about it, so you understand what they are. And the other part here is other intergenic, in which There is one part that people knew at that time what they were, microsatellites, and other, as you can see, unclassified, half billion unclassified. Okay. What is a microsatellite? Do you know what is a microsatellite? Anybody of you? Okay, let's go to the explanation. I don't remember the organization of the slides. So, okay, microsatellites are very small sequences, repeats. Like you find the stretch of 80,000 times. Okay, this is a microsatellite. They can be only two nucleotides, or three, or four, or five, depending. Which is the most known five bases repeat microsatellite in human chromosomes? I'm sure you know. Great. Telomeres, the ending part of the chromosomes, are constituted of repeats of five bases that are repeated 1,000 times. Okay? And there are many. In the human genome, there are many sections like this. And also, I spend another few minutes for this microsatellite just to comment, because microsatellites are regions that have probably no function. But they have a feature very, very important, that is, when the DNA polymerase, so during replication of DNA, okay, when the DNA polymerase arrives on microsatellites, it makes a lot of errors, because the sequence is always the same. And so sometimes it slips, and slips of three or four, and so the result of these errors in microsatellites makes the story that if we compare ourselves, if we take DNA from you, from you, from you, from me, and so on, the length of the satellites is individual. Each microsatellite has a different length in individuals, okay? And this is the reason why microsatellites are used to identify people. You can identify father, mother, and so on. So is the most common way to make this kind of, for example, analysis in crime stories or other kind of identification of the father, stories like this one. Okay, just comment. Parenthesis closed. Okay, good. So, of course, before going inside what they are, I mean, what all the sequences are, I just wanted to comment on the fact that, of course, one of the features of this result was that we had a lot of sequences. So the people started to say, okay, we cannot keep the sequences in our computers. Because probably they are going to increase. You have to see that in parallel with the human genome completion, a number of other projects of different organisms started. So the people started to say, okay, we have to keep this kind of sequences somewhere. So they created databases, biological databases, to keep this kind of sequences, organizing. Not only keep, also to organize them. There are several organizations around the world that took this job, okay? The job is to maintain and run public database on it, okay? And usually they are publicly funded agencies, okay? We are different. For example, we have one in Europe, that is the... a part of this EMBO, you know, if you have heard about EMBO, it was the European Molecular Biology Organization. They are funded by countries, okay, so the countries put money over there, and there are several laboratories around the world, also in Rome, Grenoble in France, in Barcelona, the CRG, Hamburg, Heidelberg, Germany, I mean, several labs around the world. And they, in UK, there is the EBI, that is a part of the EMBO, that is the European Bioinformatics Institute. Okay, so they keep these databases of biological sequences. And this is the browser. Oh, finally we found it. Okay, so if unfortunately I can go. Probably the one solution is to connect by my computer. I may try another assay of that. Come vuoi aprire questo file? Innanzitutto aprirlo, direi. It works, very good. Okay, so this is the first page of the browser. Okay, and as you can see, you have different stories. These are tools for analysis, okay, but we will go through, especially in the practical world, but just now to have some idea about, okay. So as you can see here, you have the search of species. So you have a long list of species of which we have partial or complete sequencing. And of course, they show as a first choice the most used sequences that are human, of course, mouse, that is the model for, let's say, most of the studies in biology, and zebrafish, that is the other very well known and used organism for biological studies. Okay? So, this is the one. Let me see, we have to go back to the presentation now, okay? And the human is there, and this, what is this? This is the release, because of course these kinds of databases, I mean, when the Human Genome Project was finished in 2003, the story was not finished. That was one sequence that was made from different DNA of, I don't remember how many donors, I think 8 donors. But as you probably imagine, the DNA of each of us is a little different, so the project continued to accumulate other data. So actually, sometimes they make an average sequence of all the humans, and they release different freezing of the sequence. Okay, so what we call the reference genome is not a real genome. It's an average of all the sequenced genomes. Okay, so this is the release 38 and so on. And there are many other stories, but we will come back to this. Okay. So if you go to the genome assembly, you have some statistics. So this is just the page. Sorry, I can go back to the site since it works. It was working before. Now it doesn't work anymore. Chissà perché ogni tanto funziona tanto. Okay, chi lo sa? Dunque, questo che cos'è? Quello è, questo è il PowerPoint. Questo. Ok, so questo è il browser. I wonder if the people in the back of the room can see anything. Very hard. Oh wow, it's difficult. Ok. So you have to make an arrangement that you exchange sometimes. One lesson here, then you go to the back. Okay, so no, just wanted to tell you something very short here. So this is the genome, blah blah, and okay, there are tools here that are for specialists, like converting one version of the genome to another version, something like this, or to download all the sequences. Don't try. The story is that they are actually completely free. This is great. I mean, you can go Tom and then download the secret strategy. They are completely free because they are publicly funded, so of course you can test that one. And there are some statistics that are interesting to see. I don't remember where. Okay, here. It's written more information and statistics. So you can click here. Okay. So you go there, and I'm sorry for because you don't see it. Maybe that I can make an arrangement here. Is that better? Is that better? No, just because the sequences. So this is the version of the assembly. Okay. This is the date in which the assembly was released. And this is the statistics. So we have inside 3.6 billion. You say, but you just say that it's 3.2 billion. This is 3.6. That's because they put in the database also variants. Okay? So this increased the number. And actually the golden path length is a little shorter. What is the gold path? Is the complete sequence of the chromosome that is without holes. You say, why I do have a hole in the chromosome? Because there are sections of the chromosomes in which, also today, we don't have complete information. And you say, why? We are so good in sequencing. Why we don't have information on some pieces? Because they are strongly repetitive sequences. And whenever you make sequencing by fragmenting, and you have strongly repetitive sequences, you never will understand how they are organized inside. Never. Okay? So there are still holes. And if you sum up all the parts that are complete, so without holes, you arrive to 3.09 billion. Okay? This is the figure. Okay, let me go to the counts. That this is very, very, very interesting. So if you go down here, you find the gene counts. So please take a look at it and then tell me if you knew more or less this figure. So coding genes. Okay, so we have 20,000 genes. Coding, that means that encode for proteins, right? Okay. Including 650 read through. Do you have an idea what is a read through? No, this is a difficult story. Sometimes you find genes in which two parts of the transcript, so the RNA that is transcribed from the genes, come from two different loci. Imagine to have a gene here, and then intergenic space, and then another gene here. And sometimes you find a transcript, so RNA, that is formed by a part coming from the first gene, and another part coming from the second gene. It's strange things, okay? They are quite rare, but at the state of today, we include those in coding genes because they have an ORF, so they have a coding sequence inside. Then, second line say non-coding genes. What is a non-coding gene? Have you ever heard about non-coding genes? Okay, as you can see, the number of non-coding genes is even higher than the coding ones. They have genes that are transcribed in RNA, okay? And this RNA has a function itself, no translation, okay? And to date, we know something like 22,000 genes that encode RNA, no translation, no protein, but they have a function themselves. They are called usually long non-coding RNA because there is another category that probably you know better than the other ones, that are the small non-coding genes. Do you know what small non-coding genes are? MicroRNA. If I say microRNA, you know what they are? Okay. So we have something like a little less than 5,000 genes encoding microRNAs. Okay? So this is the sum of non-coding genes. This is the small, this is the long. Okay? And this is a miscellaneous, so it means that there are genes that are transcribed, they give RNA, but we don't know, we cannot classify in one of the other categories. Then there are two other lines that I want to show you and spend some minutes to comment. This one is pseudogenes. Do you know what a pseudogene is?
It's a copy of the gene.
Yeah. It's a copy of a gene, but doesn't work anymore. Okay, we will see there are actually two kinds, but we will see. So the final line say gene transcripts, and this is a story that we will discuss very carefully in the future, because if you sum up the items that you see before, it doesn't make 2006. I mean 206,000. Okay? So this means that for each gene you have more transcripts. Okay? And this is absolutely true, because we will see that, for example, protein coding genes, they have an average of 8 transcripts per gene. Okay, so that's the story. Okay, this alternative sequence means that another sequence that they are classifying. Okay, and finally, just to see, and then we will discuss it more in the future. Variants means all the items in which there is a variation, individual variation of DNA, okay, from each individual to the sequence, reference sequence. And if you see, we have a huge number of variants in this genome, okay. We will see them in. So if we come back to the presentation. Okay. How to manage? Yeah. Okay. We will see. This was the same story. So we just to tell you what they are and the numbers. Okay. So starting, then we stop for a minute, but just. See that. Okay, this is the classification of the repetitive sequences. You remember that right part of the story there, okay? So you have mini satellites, microsatellites, or satellites definition from geneticists means every sequence that is tandem repeated is a satellite. If they are very short, they are microsatellites. If they are a little longer, like 10 nucleotides are mini satellites, if it's longer, satellites. Okay, and this is the number of events that you find in the human genome. Events means that we have 426,000 places in our genome where there is a satellite, either satellite or mini satellite or microsatellite. Okay, so huge. The overall coverage means the part of the genome that is involved in is 3%, and the length may be from 2 to 100, okay, of each. Okay, then we have this sign, line, DNA transposon, and LTR transposons that are very curious, and I will show you what they are. Sign means short interspersed elements. Short, why? Short because they are, as you can see, 100 to 300 nucleotide long. There is a huge number of those in the human genome. 1,800,000. Make a calculation, please. If you divide, do you have a calculator? 3.2 billion. Then divide this by this number, please. What you get?
Okay, so means that 2,000.
That means that every 2,000 nucleotides in our genome, you have a repetitive sequence. It's real, something like a mitragliatore. Okay, they are really incredible. Okay, then there are the second category is DNA transposons. I explain you in a minute the difference. We have more or less 500,000 copies, 3% of the genome, 200 to 2,000 length. We have LTR retrotransposons. We have something like 700,000 copies around the genome. That makes 9% of our genome, and they are from 200 to 5,000 nucleotide long. And then the line. The line is a really spectacular story because they are quite long sequences from 500 to 8,000. We have 1,500,000 copies of these lines. Okay, they make something like 21%. Incredible. Okay, and then we have a story that we know better: ribosomal DNA, ribosomal RNA encoding genes. As you probably remember, they are repeated. We have many copies of the genes encoding for ribosomal RNA because we need a lot just for that reason. Every cell needs a lot. We have more or less 700 copies of the this ribosomal DNA in tandem, and they occupy 0.01% of the genome. This is the length. Okay, and then there are other elements that are, for example, duplicated sections or whatever that accomplish for 0.2 of the genome. And this is just the distribution through the chromosomes. Okay, so in this graph, you see from chromosome 1 to chromosome X and Y here, and you have the distribution. It's not that different, but there are differences in between. Okay, so the gray are mini satellites, and then size and lines and whatever. Okay. Good. This is good to know. This again is not to see in the numbers again because okay, we don't make this kind of analysis, but just to say that there are subtypes of each of them. So not all the signs are the same. We don't have 1,700,000 times the same, exactly the same sequence. They are families. Okay? For example, the most common in humans is the ALU sequence. Okay? And then you have MIR, and MIR, several families of MIR, MIR1, MIR2, MIR3, blah, 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 blah. And they are more rare. So in this figure, you see only the most frequent. Okay? Same story for the lines. You have line one, that is the most frequent, 500,000 copies around. Then you have line two, that is 300,000, and line three is 37. Then we have other variants that are more rare. Then LTR elements, you see a number, a little smaller number around, but always classes. And this is DNA transposons. DNA transposons, again, they have different names, HET, TCI, PIGBAC, and other stories. Okay, they are, they have low number of copies, and anyway, that's the story. Now we can call Y family. So why we have many copies of different families in the genome? The reason why is that all these elements belong to a class of genetic elements that we call transposable elements, TE. And they have the capacity of replicating and inserting in the genome in a different place. It's very similar. So it's not the same mechanism often, but it's very similar to what happened to retroviruses. Do you know retroviruses?
Yes.
Okay, they usually infect the RNA virus. They infect the cells. They carry a protein that is the retrotranscriptase. They make a cDNA copy of themselves. And then this copy is integrated in the chromosomes, right? Well, usually it stays as a provirus. Good, okay? These elements have a similar way to go, okay? Depending on the classes of the stories, okay? So, let me find first the transposons and then we go back. Okay, so this is the slide I was looking for. So this, for example, are the LTRs and ERVs that you have seen as a classification. Okay, they have a structure like this one. Wait, I have another slide that is larger. Okay, so you can see better. So these, as you can see, they are units in which you have LTR, that means long terminal repeats, as in the case of retroviruses, both sides. And they have a function of promoters and termination sites. Okay. And then they encode genes. And you can see very clearly that these genes are the same that you find in retroviruses. Okay? So from that similarity, we derived that this name, ERVs, means endogenous retroviruses. Okay? They can be changed a little more, a little less. I mean, during evolution, they changed, they mutated. So not all of the copies that we have inside our genome is still able to encode GAG, POL, and DEM. Okay? Most of them are deficitary. They are mutated, not working. But still there are some copies that are still capable of encoding these these enzymes, and these enzymes, of course, are essential for replication. We'll see in a minute. Then we have a line. The line is a little different because, as you can see, there is no same kind of genes inside, and then there is no LTR on the two sides. They have a 5' UTR and 3' UTR that have more or less the same function. So they are promoters for Pol2, for the polymerase, RNA polymerase, and they have a polyadenylation signal here, so they can stop the transcription. And they have two ORFs. Do you know what is a ORF? Open reading frame, encoding sequence. Okay, so they encode, typically they encode two proteins. One is a retrotranscriptase, the other one is a homing nuclease. I mean, a protein that is capable of cutting the chromosome and inserting the cDNA inside. So they move this way, okay? And the sign is actually a different story completely, smaller, and it doesn't come from any reminiscent virus. This comes from endogenous genes. And it is transcribed by Pol3. This suggests strongly that it derives from the genes that are transcribed normally by Pol3. Which are the genes that are transcribed by Pol3? tRNA and some other small RNA. Okay? So it's very similar to tRNA and other genes like this one. Okay? So they are copies. So how these copies move, how they proliferate? Okay, the mechanism is, again, it's very similar to the retrovirus. Okay, so occasionally, all these kinds of sequences can be transcribed in a cell. Okay, so you find RNA, and you can find it. On Monday, we had a small congress seminar for the doctorate. There were five invited speakers that are specialists of this line and transposon and so on, and they showed us results in which you can really find in normal tissues, you can find this transcription of these lines and signs and whatever. Of course, finding the transcription, transcribed RNA doesn't mean that this will result in another copy, because maybe the RNA is just degraded and so on. So it needs to be converted in cDNA and then home to a chromosome, so it's not that. But also one of these researchers showed us that sometimes during development, and they use the zebrafish to show it, especially in the nervous tissue, in the developing nervous systems, you have actually homing in a different place. So sometimes they move, okay? That's the story. But the problem is that if they move in somatic cells, who cares? I mean, if you have a movement, replication and insertion of this sequence in a somatic cell, nobody will remember it. Okay? This movement to be conserved in evolution has to happen in germ cells. Otherwise, no conservation. So we evaluated actually the movement of these transposons. They are called retrotransposons because they have to be retrotranscribed to transpose. It happens more or less one time every 200 generations. So it's not that frequent. I know you feel all this DNA that is moving in your body. It's not that much. Don't be worried. Okay. Anyway, this is the story. And then we have other kinds of transposons. One is this DNA transposon. It's completely different from that. Okay, and it moves not. It doesn't make copies, retrocopies. Okay, it moves by a cutting and inserting mechanism. Okay, there are two categories. One is just cutting and moving. Another one is replicating and then moving. But this is a DNA polymerase dependent mechanism, not RNA polymerase. Okay, And typically, they encode for a transposase, that is an enzyme that homes the sequence in another part of the chromosome. Then we have this mite, that is a minute, they probably are derived from the transposon by deletion of the gene. So they only have these terminal repeats in the same orientation, but they are not able to move themselves, of course, because they are not sufficient to move. But of course, if you have one copy that is active here, you may have in the cell some transposases, and it may move also different sequences. So they are just parasites of this one. They can move. Actually, these are the canonical lines and LTR and whatever, okay, the canonical one. But actually, in our genomes, we have very, very frequently, we have mutated versions of these guys, okay? So very, very frequently you have, for example, you find solitary LTRs. That means that there is only the LTR coming from herbs, okay, and not the genes inside. So you find only this LTR there. Or truncations, like this one. This is clearly a line that lose the first part here, okay? So. Or signs that are shorter than the regular one. Okay, so you have many events like this one. Because actually they are not, probably not functional sequences, so they are highly mutated, of course. They are not subject to selective pressure. Okay, so they are highly mutated. Okay. Just one comment to end this first part of the lesson, then we have a coffee. But do you, any one of you can guess which kind of problem can LTR give to the our genome? I mean, you have had a strange mutation in which LTR from an herb is for some way mutated and went to another location in the genome. And then you find LTR inserted there. Can it give problems to the normal metabolism in the cell? Please.
Maybe it could create another gene downstream.
Yeah. This is one of the stories that people are studying today, because, as you know, for example, in cancer, there is a high instability of the genome. So this kind of recombination is quite frequent. So you can find part of a line that is close to a normal coding gene, and it will encode a RNA with it, so it will completely subvert the regulation of the gene. For example, last year, in collaboration with people at the RCC in Candiolo, we have found a line 1 MET mutation. MET is an oncogene. And in breast cancer, there is exactly this event. So you have a part of a line 1 that has jumped close to the MET gene, and so it drives overexpression of this MET gene. Common story. So just to say you that don't take the repetitive transposable elements like, okay, they are just, okay, who cares? They are probably very important, more important than we think. Okay? Have a coffee? Okay, this slide, just to tell you that you have to understand that this repetitive... Please. These repetitive sequences are really spread around. There is no logic, okay? You can find copies intragenic, intergenic, or whatever. This is just a figure that illustrates this concept. I try to guide you through the slide. This is a fragment of a human genome, a fragment of 50 kilobases from here to here. Okay? Have you got this point? Yes. Then in this figure you see three
four coding genes. This is one, PKP2, that starts from here and ends here. Then you have a second gene that is SYB1, starts here and ends here. And this one that is longer, and another one here from here. Okay? So you have four genes in this fragment. And if you look, the color code, I'm sorry for the quality, is very bad. This is a line. Okay? So wherever you see this color means that you have a line inside. And as you can see, you have lines intergenic, but you also have lines intragenic. There is an example where this, okay. This is an intron, you see? The yellow part is the intron. Can you follow me? And inside the intron you have lines, okay? And same story for science, LTR, whatever. So they can be wherever. Okay? That's what the concept to say. Then, I have some other explanation about repetitive sequences that we were talking about before. This is, for example, I say five, actually six. Sorry for that mistake. Telomeres, okay, you have short repetitive sequences here. Okay? In this part. These are thousands of copies of the same sequence. Okay? Then you have the same story, the satellites also in centromere. Same story, but this is not microsatellite, it's satellite, because they are 100 vespers that are repeated several times. Okay. So this is what we call tandem repeat. And as you know, this is probably the only sequence that we can associate to a function in the satellites, okay? Because the telomere, as you remember, is as a function to protect the end of the chromosome and also to replicate the tandem. You remember the story of shortening and then by the telomerase that keeps the length of the chromosomes correctly. And the centromere, of course, they have the function of binding the mitotical apparatus. So what about the pseudogenes? We didn't talk about the pseudogenes. You remember that there is a huge number of pseudogenes. We evaluate that more or less each coding gene has at least one pseudogene in the genome. So it's a long story again. And there are two kinds of pseudogenes in the genome. One is the classical pseudogene that is comes from the same evolutionary mechanism that made gene families. That means making a copy of a gene, okay, and then variation. Okay, if this mutation of one gene copy gives a good result, let's say, you can have another gene that is similar to the original one, and so we have gene families, like the one that you saw before, the globins or whatever. In other cases, this mutation is so heavy that completely loses the property of the genes, like, for example, mutating the promoter, mutating the exon intron borders or whatever, and then it becomes a pseudogene. We recognize it because of similarity. So the sequence has a strong similarity with the original parental gene, but no function anymore. Okay. And then we have the other kind of pseudogenes are what we call processed pseudogenes. And the difference is that when you find a pseudogene in the genome, it has a classical exon intron structure. It means that it has derived from a duplication event, okay? But if you find sequences that are similar to a gene but without intron inside, it means that they have been processed. So the genesis of these processed pseudogenes is the same genesis of the repetitive elements we talked about before. So the gene is transcribed, it makes RNA without intron, of course. The splicing process will remove the introns. And at this point, there is, for some reason,
it has been make a retro copy of this RNA. Okay, so this RNA has been copied back to a cDNA, probably because sometimes the LTR or elements or whatever, they express this kind of retrotranscriptase occasionally. And so, of course, this retrotranscriptase can also retrotranscribe cDNA. This cDNA copy has been homed to a different place in the somewhere in the genome. Okay. Good.
So yeah. We can distinguish them thanks to the presence or not of the intron.
Of the intron. Yeah. If an intron is retained, it means that is a duplicating event. Otherwise, again, don't think that the pseudogene contains all the coding sequence or whatever. Usually, it's a kind of error. So it's a probably a part or fragment of the gene and whatever. Okay, good. Questo l'abbiamo visto. So conclusion for the 2003, because at that point we have only a small fraction of the human genome sequence could be attributed with a function, okay? So they classified like the trees that you see before, but more or less in a very imperfect way, say, okay? And at that point, essentially everybody thought that all this DNA, non-coding DNA, was junk DNA. This was a story that had been adversed by many scientists, especially evolutionary biologists, because they say they make comparison of different genomes from different species and found that many of these junk DNA actually was very conserved between the species. And conservation means selective pressure. And selective pressure means that they have something, some important function in the organism, otherwise it's not. So the scientists actually started several projects in 2003 to give functions to the genome, to non-coding genome. Okay, so essentially, one of the way to go was the comparative way, so to extend this sequencing of different organisms to understand by comparing them what was the story. So there are many public sequencing projects, okay, so many consortia around the world that are still today working on sequencing of different organisms. And there are also private companies that do, especially in bacteria, of course, companies that make antibiotics or whatever, they sequence the microbes, say that, and they keep the sequence secret. They don't say anybody the sequence. Or plants, especially the companies that make variants for plants for production, like Monsanto or whatever, and they keep the sequence secret, of course, for industrial reasons. Okay. So, but most of the sequences actually is public. And again, if you can go to Ensemble. What is this? Okay. It works. Great. Okay. So if you go to the Ensemble, you have a long list of genomes that are being sequenced or they are under the process of being sequenced. And you see here a long list. This is just in a alphabetical order. This is the taxon identification number, so the classification, and this is the model, and so on. And there are many. I can go through, but I prefer that the curious of you may be that going home, they will open the ensemble and see how many species and how many stories have been sequenced. Okay, you have the pictures there. So there's also the cat.
C. elegans, I mean, many chicken, chimpanzee, many cow. And you can select from the first page, you can select the class of the organism. I don't remember where, but somewhere you can choose the filter. Okay, so you can filter here mammalians or so the occasion is to also to the occasion is also to introduce you a different database, a different genome browser as well. So this is the European one, and we have two big other organizations. One is in Japan that we avoid. I have nothing against the Japanese, just not to make a classification. The other one is NCBI, that is important to know. NCBI is in USA, actually. And this time it doesn't work. È abbastanza spettacolare questa cosa. Eccolo qua. Fine. Okay, so this is the NCBI site. This is is kept by the National Institute of Health, that is a corresponding of Istituto Superiore di Sanità. In the USA, and they have a site that is a little different, but actually they have the same sequences, more or less, but it's a little different from the story. And you see here you have a facility to browse organisms here. So if you click this link, you go to the list of the again, to the list of all the genomes that have been sequenced, whatever. You have filters somewhere, I don't remember where, but you can put a filter. But just look at the numbers. Can you see over there? I read for you. This is eukaryotes. We have 8,032 species of eukaryotes sequenced. We never know that we have so many organisms in the earth. Usually we know the cat, dog, a few others, fly. Okay. And then you have something like impressive number of prokaryotes. Can you see the number? 193,000 species of prokaryotes, sequence. Yeah. Real story. This is 29,000 viruses, plasmids and organelles, so mitochondria, plastids and so on. But we have something like eukaryotes. So you go to eukaryotes, you find everything you want. And in this figure you have some interesting story, that is they also have a symbol here that is the completion status. This is a cake graph, in which it means that how much has been completed the sequence. Then you have other information like the genome size and blah blah, and the number of coding sequences inside, blah blah. So you can explore the stuff. Let's go back to the lesson. So this is the just the presentation of NCBI. NCBI has been actually the very first browser. During the Human Genome Project phases, this was the site accumulating all the sequences and making it public. There was a convention in between the countries, different countries, that the sequences deposited in the database should be made public in 24 hours. So no secret, I mean, everything good. The problem is Trump.
Because no, I'm not kidding. Because you know, American first. So the problem is that is they started to say that this has been probably should be reserved to the USA and not made public. This is a strange story. But anyway, for the moment, it works. We can access, and okay. So this is a part of the National Institute of Health here. I don't go through this one. We don't have time. Just you can go if you want, and just to know what they are. National Institute of Health is an enormous organization in USA for the health. This is the National Library of Medicine. And I assure you, just because this is what keeps the famous PubMed. Do you know what is PubMed? Probably used that. And this is kept by the National Library of Medicine, that is a subsection of the NIH. And this, in the National Library of Medicine, there is the National Center for Biotechnological Information, that is the database of sequences. Okay, so browsers. Then, what we have to comparative, we were talking about comparative, the genomes are very different in the different class of organisms, okay? So in this figure you have just compared the human piece of a chromosome, the same that you saw before in the 50 kb expanded, say. This is our friend, the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that is the yeast, the small yeast. Okay, this is Drosophila melanogaster, common fly for experiments, and this is a plant, nice. Okay, and just to compare them, and again, you see that this is the situation in vertebrates in general. Okay, so you have few genes interspersed in intergenic regions, but if you look at Saccharomyces cerevisiae, for example, the situation is completely different. Most of the genome is gene. So you have some transposons. This TI2 is a transposon that is typical for yeast, but they're rare. Most of the genome is compacted in this gene, okay? And Drosophila melanogaster is a kind of in between the two situations. So the genomes are like this. And the plants are really terrible because they have huge genomes in which there is really nothing. I mean, you have sometimes you find genes and then all the rest is repetitive sequences. So we don't know exactly why, but this situation. Okay, so this exon indron structure is present in all eukaryotes. Okay, we are running late today. No problem. We take this. Sorry, but I just wanted to comment on this because it's important. Let's take a look at different organisms in the evolutionary scale and see how many introns per gene they present. Average, of course. Okay. It's not a fixed number. I mean, the range is very high. But so, just to show you, this is the yeast here. Okay. This is the Drosophila melanogaster you saw before. And this is a plant, and this is Mus musculus, mouse and human. Okay, as you can see, there is an increasing number of introns per gene during evolution. So the phenomenon of having the genes fragmented is already present in lower eukaryotes, but it has expanded a lot with the evolution. Okay, so in looking. This is the averages in human genome for protein coding genes, of course. You have 8.8 now exons per gene average, and the exon length is around 170 base pairs, so very small, with a narrow range also. Okay, 85% of exons are less than 200 base pairs. The intron length is very variable. On average, you have 5,400 base pairs, average. But you have a situation in which you have as small as 20 base pairs and as large as 100 kb. entrance. Okay. You see the range here. So sometimes you have intronless genes. In the human genome, we have around 3,000 intronless genes. So no introns. Okay. And we have some genes that are really huge. For example, the NAP gene has 147 introns. So it's kind of enormous genes with completely fragmented. Okay, so another comparative figure, just to see. Okay, this on your left is the exon length in BP, in base pairs. And we compare in green the Homo sapiens, and in blue the worm, you know, the small Senorhabditis elegans. Okay, and in red we have the Drosophila. Okay, and you see here that the Homo sapiens converge to have very small exons. Okay, so there is a very low number of exons that are more than 200, 300. On the contrary, lower organisms have, on average, larger exons. Okay, and the other way around, if you look at the introns. So in the right part of the figure, you see the introns. This is a intron less than 100, from 100 to 2,000, 2,000 to 5,000, and more than that. And you see that the frequency in the blue and red, so the worm and the Drosophila, as you can see, they have smaller introns on average. While human, they stay here, so they have longer introns. Okay, so this kind of tendency in your evolution to have more introns, larger introns, and smaller exons. Okay. Of course, there are exceptions. Like, for example, in the neuroexin gene, there is one intron that is 500,000 bases. Kind of strange story. Okay, what about the dimension of the coding sequences? Because we saw this big, large difference, exon introns, in between the organisms. So we can think about the coding sequence. Is that the coding sequence also variable in the organism? No. That's the other impressive story, is that when you look, okay, I try to guide you to this slide. This is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the first line, SC. Just look at the Homo sapiens. Okay, Drosophila is there. Just look at the three lines, because otherwise it's too big. And this is the mean and standard deviation of the ORFs. And as you can see, the length of the ORFs, operating frames, is more or less the same. It's conserved. Why? So why you have this kind of variation exon introns and not in the probably this is a problem of the structure of the proteins. So too few amino acids don't make a protein. But if you have too large number of amino acids in the protein, this probably makes problems in the folding. Okay? I mean, this is a possible explanation. Okay? But if you look in the evolutionary scale, there is no average change in the length of the protein. Good, so another story. Okay, we can skip this one. I wanted to go to the genome browser, but we don't have time today. Just a short list, can I do? Let me just go to the NCBI. We haven't seen it before, so just to show you how a genome browser works. Again, I have to make all this story. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Is that one the one? Okay. So, this is just a sub. When you are in NCBI, you have this menu that is just drives you to subsection of the database. Okay? So one of the sections that we see now is the gene section. Okay? Gene. Okay? So this is a catalog of all the genes that we know in the human or mouse or whatever. In this moment we go to the human. Let me put a name of a gene that we know. We used ERBB2 yesterday. Can we continue with ERBB2? Okay. Okay, when I ask for the gene ERBB2, it gives a long list. Don't be surprised, because I never filter about the organism. I just ask it for ERBB2, so it gives me the list of all the genes called ERBB2 in all the organisms that you see before. So, millions, okay? So we have to choose the one. This is ERBB2 receptor tyrosine kinase 2, Homo sapiens. I read it for the last line. Click over there, and we go to a page that has all the information about the gene. And this is exactly what I told you yesterday, when you don't know something. Go there, and you have a short information that gives you an overview, correct, focus it on what the gene encodes. You cannot read it, but I can. That this gene encodes a member of the epidermal growth factor receptor family of receptor tyrosine kinases. This protein has no ligand binding domain, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so it gives you basic information about it. Okay, but then go to the browser, because this is only information. And then this starts with the browser. It gives you the position on the chromosome. Dici che posso farlo un po' più grosso? Let me do a little bit larger, because otherwise people here is completely lost. Okay. Chromosome 17, and it gives you the position of the gene here as compared to other genes in the chromosome. This is the initial position, this is the final position of this part of the chromosome containing the gene. And then you go down, and this is what we call really a genome browser. Okay? What is a genome browser? This is an interface that allows you to see the gene. Okay? You are looking at the gene. This is positions of the chromosome. Here, 39, virgola, c'è scritto, comma 685K, that means that this position is 39,675,000, blah, 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 from the beginning of the chromosome, okay? And this is the scale, okay? So it continues. And what is this? These are the transcripts coming from the gene. Okay? So what they show you is not the gene itself, but the transcript coming from the gene. Okay? So, as I told you before, each gene has several transcripts. As you can see there. And now, try just today to take as a final message, just try to see, to interpret what you see on the figure. Let me make a little larger. Okay? And let me move it. Because you can move it. You can move all over the chromosome. If you are patient enough, you can explore all the chromosome like this. And you can see here how they are depicted. Let me a little larger again. Okay? So this is the beginning. There is a small arrow. Can you see the arrow? The arrow says that the gene is read that direction. Okay, so this will be the 5', right, of the messenger. And so what is the big box? We have big boxes and small lines. What is this? You can guess. Exons and introns, okay? So this is an exon, And this is the first entrance. Then you have the second exit, second entrance, and blah, blah. Okay? So why they show five different transcripts? They seem very similar in this part, right? They are not. Can I enlarge a little bit more? Okay. What has changed from this story? You see now the difference? They start from different positions. So the initial point of the RNA transcript is different from those. Okay? Good. Then another particular is this one. You see that the box is in part light green and in part is dark green. What does it mean? Here, look at this. This is the ensemble gene that makes the sum of all the transcripts that you see there. Okay. So there is a light green and a dark green.
Maybe the darker is the part in common of all?
No. What do you have in the 5' of a messenger RNA? What do you find? You should know. So the transcription starts here, and the RNA starts there. Then the primary transcript contains everything, right? Introns and so on. The first part, is it coding?
No.
So this is the what we call the 5' UTR, 5' untranslated region. Okay? And this in dark part means that here you have ATG. So you have this start codon. Okay? The dark regions are the coding sequence of the okay. I put you I will open a small exercise on this so you can start just looking at the browser and making your opinion on genes a little more solid. Okay? Sorry for the time. I had another slide, but we can see next time. So okay. Come si fa a chiudere sto affare qua? Let's go into the last slide just to remember, okay? No class tomorrow. For me. Okay? For me, no class tomorrow. I told you already. And then this is there are the two readings that you have to do before Monday morning. Okay?
So the exercise will stop Monday morning?
No. No, vi apro un esercizio. I will open an exercise on the browser in the afternoon and then you will have 1 week to do it.
How?
It's not cogent today, so